We'd like to welcome everybody tonight to Karen's Teleseminar. I'm your host, Melinda Garish. I'm from Shirley, Indiana. And we will get started tonight. We've had several questions submitted through our email, and we've selected five topics tonight. And the topics for tonight are, the first one will be the Stop Trailside Grass Grabber. And then we've got Communicating with Mules and Donkeys, the Frightened Horse Behavior, and Delusion Characteristics, and Photonic Light Philosophy. So, Karen, are you ready to go ahead and start with your first question?
Sure, let's go.
Okay. This one is says that my horse is a Percheron Thoroughbred and is dominant and on the trails is easygoing. He has been named at my barn the Bulldozer. I take dressage lessons and trail ride, and the classical dressage has helped me relax and allow my horses to be lighter and more responsive instead of the forward freight train he can be. He is extremely food and treat-oriented. Here is my problem. The last trail ride, he continually pulled the reins from my hands and dove for grass. I thought I had asked him respectively to go forward with my legs. No response, so I used the aid of a crop behind my leg. He bucked, and I, not a small woman, went airborne, and I hit hard on the ground. Pulling up on the reins does not seem to work since he is extremely strong in the front. He wears a snaffle bit and is not a nervous horse. Help, I've lost my confidence on the trail, and it is what I love most. Any tips with spring coming to help in my horse not always pulling his head down for what he sees as a food fest? He's an easy keeper and not thin at all, and he is extremely loved and taken care of. Please teach me to take care of me. How can I start to fix his food obsession?
Okay. Well, listening to questions like this, you become a little bit of a detective. And the tendency sounds like, you know, when I hear kind of key words there, extremely loved, okay, well taken care of, easy keeper, these kinds of things. His name is a Bulldozer. You know, to me, those are all indications that the horse is very good at making the decisions, whether we're aware of it or not. If the horse is a bulldozer, would he be a bulldozer with a herd of mares? See, it'd be a different deal. And that's what I really try to teach people, is that herd dynamics are very specific. And a horse, we kind of take a horse and say, well, I want this horse to be my companion, be my friend, enjoy what we're doing as much as I do, all of these kinds of things. And one of the common things, and I'm not saying it's going on here, but it could be definitely contributing to it, is, if we come from a family where food equals love, a lot of times what horses do, when out come the treats, or treats are part of your regular routine with a horse, those kinds of things, the horse really almost can't help himself but to make those decisions. See, horses don't have that dynamic among the herd. A horse doesn't go over to another horse and want them to like them and give them treats to do that. See, it's not in their natural, conditioning or society, in horse land. So what happens when we start getting into the habit of giving horses treats, and I have nothing against giving horses treats or enjoying giving them food, things like that, but it's not when they're expecting it. It's unpredictable times, and after every time I give my horse food or treats or something like that, I have to recondition them to say, now there's no treats, and they may look for it for, two or three more days. They may still be coming in, and I'll see a behavior of like, well, what about the treats? Do you have treats? How about today? How about now? Do you have any treats? And I catch myself and go, no, there are no treats forever. Okay, that's how, it has to come across. So there's a balance, and that's an element of leadership there. So when a horse is a bulldozer or has that tendency, to have a lot of forward, which is the majority of horses, that's the direction they go mostly, the things that you can do that will really make the difference and earn leadership points for you is to teach your horse, both on the ground and horseback, is to go backwards and sideways. that is the fastest way to gain leadership points with a horse. So first on the ground, have your horse respect your personal space. Until you invite, any time a horse comes into my personal space, uninvited. See, and I don't respond to that like a lead horse would. I'm conditioning my horse, yes, you're right, you're the lead horse, you're making the decisions, I'm not right now, you know. So when you get into situations where we're kind of, oh, I don't want to hurt his feelings, and this is how he is, and things like that, and please go back to my newsletter in January, and it talks about the dangers of labeling a horse, because what we tend to do if we say, well, he's a bulldozer and he's pushier, this or that or the other, whatever the label is, what we tend to do is when we see behavior that matches that label, we tend to not respond to in an opportunity to shape the behavior. We tend to look at it and go, well, that's just the way he is. And this happens in human relations as well. Kids will get labeled. I talk to adults all the time and ask, you know, who's been labeled? Who was one of those kids? And sometimes in our family dynamics, we can be grown adults and still, you know, bear that label in the family. It can be very harmful, because that's when people only see the behavior that matches their idea and their expectations of us. So there is an opportunity when a horse is acting like a, quote, bulldozer, to respond appropriately and say, you know, you can bulldoze other people, but not me. And that's what a lead horse would do. It's very important to understand that. So when you... That's the other detective moment I heard was, you know, the horse dove for the grass, and you can't pull a horse's head up. I mean, you see it with kids all the time. The horse says, "Up, time to eat grass," and the kid's up there crying, flailing their legs, and the horse is just munching away. They're so strong. So, again, it goes back to about changing the horse's mind about those things. So what I would do is I'd go out online, not horseback, because you've kind of lost your confidence there, and the horse has learned, like, well, I'll just launch you in the air. You know, I want to eat grass. And I'd do that, too, if I was busy eating, you know, putting down a whole cheesecake and you came and interrupted my cheesecake. So, you know, you have to kind of look at it, you know, from the horse's point of view, and take the opportunity online, halter and lead, and take the horse out to a grassy, lush grassy area, and just stand there. And when the horse puts their head down to eat, you use an extension of your arm or the end of a lead rope, and you wave it, and then you bite them right on the top of the hip. And not hard. It doesn't have to be a big whack or anything like that. Just something that they don't want to feel again. And just one time, put it down, and then they'll drop their head again, wave it again, bite them on the top of the hip. If they jump forwards, tip their nose back. This is on, you know, Cornerstone for Communication, Riding from the Ground, all these, you know, rein positions from the ground, and have the horse stand there and let it become the horse's idea to not eat the grass. Every time I put my head down, my butt hurts. And pretty soon the horse goes, you know, I don't think I wanted that grass after all. See, it's about allowing the horse to change their mind. And that's a really key piece to understand. But I do it first on the ground, because when you get out into a situation, you know, like you were in, you know, the horse has its head down. You can't pull it up with your hands. And then you said, okay, well, I asked polite. I was fair with my legs. Well, fair doesn't mean anything to a horse. I doubt your horse, when it was munching down, even felt your legs. You know, they're busy. They are doing their number one thing, which is to, you know, consume mass quantities. So do that first on the ground until the horse, you can stand there with your horse, and your horse just won't even look at the grass. And it really doesn't take very long. It doesn't take very long. But if your horse is called the bulldozer, probably the pattern of behavior you're going to see from your horse is when you put pressure on the top of the hip, that horse, I'm just guessing, is going to jump towards you. And that's when you need to be like, you know, Ninja Woman and have your, you know, stick ready. And I wouldn't use a whip or a lunge whip or anything like that, nothing that's flexible. It needs to be something that's rigid. That's why I have the tools that I have made are rigid, so that I can reposition towards the nose and back that horse out of my personal space. So it's kind of a tricky thing to do, because you're talking to the hindquarters to raise the head up, okay, rather than pulling it. I don't even pull on the head, not one bit. Just put the pressure on the hip. And every woman knows that we go in the living room to pick up the kids' toys, and we're leaning over, and our honey comes by, and where does he spank us? Right on the hindquarters, and the first thing that happens to us is our head pops up, and we turn around and go, hey, quit that, I hit when you do that. See, you're doing the same kind of thing to the horse. Once you get that on the ground with your halter and lead, you feel comfortable and confident doing that, then put yourself in that situation, put you and your horse in that situation, go out to the grass and just repeat the same exercise. If you feel uncomfortable being up on the horse's back in that situation, just step down. It doesn't really matter. The horse will get the idea regardless of where you're at, whether on the ground or on the horse's back. That's why I call the ground skills part of my program riding from the ground, because there's no difference in your communication. Your expectation, your clarity of communication, your rein position, everything. Your lead line is your rein. So it's all of those things that will, you know, build up to that. And that's the thing, you know, classical dressage is a wonderful study. It's absolutely wonderful. But sometimes behaviorally it doesn't give you the, you know, address some of the variety of things like trail loading or crossing water or eating grass on the trail, you know, things like that. It's important to keep gathering a broad range of information, you know, in addition to what you're developing with your seat and your balance and your horse listening to your leg and things like that, because that's it's a broader subject. And this is what I describe on the video on Facebook and my website, where horsemanship is a very broad subject and riding is a slice of that subject. So if I can put that concept and idea out there for people, then the study of horsemanship is more than just seat, legs, balance, rein position, the horse and self-carriage. You know, those are all wonderful things to study, but it's important to keep broadening your study, you know, beyond that to address these kinds of situations. So I hope that gives you an idea what to do. Start on the ground, go up onto the horse's back, and instead of talking to the front end, we want to address the mouth. The mouth seems to be what's not listening to us. But if you talk to the hindquarters, you'll change the horse's mind about what it's doing with its mouth. So hopefully that'll help you out with that.
Okay. And Kathleen, we want to thank you for submitting your question, and we believe you'll find that information to be very helpful, and like to hear back if that works for you. Are you ready to go on to the second question?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. So this one will be kind of interesting. I'm anxious to hear what you have to say on it, and it's about the mules and the donkeys. Not that I have either one of these, but I hear a lot of people that have this question. So it says, hello, Karen, and this is from Carol. I am very encouraged when you mention in Cornerstone for Communication that your program works for mules and donkeys too. Very few clinicians will allow both equine groups in their clinic. They either work with one or the other and not both horses and donkeys and mules. My question is your timing the same in working with mules and donkeys? Is there anything different to keep in mind? My 12-year-old mammoth is gentle but very abrasive. I want to teach him to be softer, but it seems I get no response to either the steady or the rhythmic pressure. He just leans and leans. And then the mule, she's a big pusher. So is it the same thing, the mama's bite, when they are just not responding to you, or how do I know if they're just not understanding?
Okay, it's a really good question. And, you know, it's an interesting comment that you made at the beginning, Carol, about other educators that don't include both. I don't know of any. I'm sure that there are, but I don't know of any. A really wonderful teacher that specializes in mules and donkeys is Brad Cameron. No relation to Craig, just his name's Brad Cameron. And I caught a clinic of his a few years ago, and he's really terrific, a wonderful muleman and teacher, and, you know, he really, really did a nice job. And there's a wonderful saying about mules and donkeys is that you have to treat a mule the way you should treat a horse. And what that means to me is that mules are less tolerant of our beginning kind of early stages. If we're not effective in our communication, the mule says, keep trying, you'll get it eventually. And a horse will kind of put up with us, you know, a little bit more. They're more accommodating. And I think, to be honest, that's why more people have horses than mules, because, you know, mules are labeled. Again, there's that labeling thing. Labeled as difficult and stubborn and things like that. And I have not found a mule that is difficult or stubborn when you learn to be effective. So here's how you remind yourself to be effective. If you put a mule out with a herd of mules or horses, you know, equine, if you put them out with a group of minis, how would they treat them? See, and when you ask yourself that question, anytime you have a question about horses or mules or minis or, you know, fill in the blank, you know, whatever your horse's brain type is, you know, any of those things, breeds, you can go back to, if you put them out with a herd of horses, how would that herd of horses treat them? What would the dynamic be? So with a mule, if and this is an interesting pattern of behavior, because with horses, the number one survival mechanism in a horse is flight. Okay, and if they don't have flight, then they'll fight. So donkeys have grown up, they have lived in very, very rocky, high mountain areas. So their number one survival mechanism isn't necessarily flight, because it's not safe. So a mechanism, probably, I don't know if it's number one or two, but it's right in there, is to stand still. So if a donkey gets attacked in a rocky area by, say, a pack of coyotes or wolves or something, their best option for survival might be to hold their ground and kick and strike. And they're very effective with their feet, and kick and strike the predators away until they give up. So if you think about it, when your mule is confused, it just, like if a horse is confused, a horse tends to just, don't ask questions, let's get out of here. Okay, they tend to react like that. Where mules and donkeys will tend to plant their feet and go, I don't know what to do. My first option might be just to stand here until, you know, something becomes clear to me. But if I were a lead horse and I were the lead horse over that mule, I would do just what, you know, horses would naturally do. They'd tin their ears, that posture of pressure, wave of warning, and then a bite. And it's just one bite. It's not until they move. It's just one bite, and give them a minute to think, and then present it again. So horses, donkeys, mules, minis, you know, gated horses, it doesn't matter. They all learn in sequential patterns. So they start to recognize the pattern. There's a posture, pressure, a wave of warning, and then a bite. But if you don't make it something that they don't want to feel again, then they're confused. So when you said, you know, my horse, you know, the mule's not responding, is it because they're confused? The answer is yes. They are confused because you didn't bite them. See, if it were a horse biting them, it'd be very clear, right from the first contact, wouldn't it? And that's a really hard thing to do, especially when the animal is standing there going, you know, what was that? You know, you've never really done that before. And so it takes a presentation of that sequence. So it's a posture, pressure, wave of warning, a bite, and then a release. And I mean quit like you're never going to do it again, and then start the sequence again. And it's really amazing. I'm headed up to Denver here tomorrow to the Rocky Mountain Horse Expo, and I have a series of presentations with a variety of horses, a variety of different subjects. And what I like to share with the audience is to observe the sequence of behaviors. Now the horse or the donkey or the mule can respond in lots of different ways. So if say, a horse, you know, jumps out and starts running around, and that's not what I was asking it to do, I would tip its nose back to say, hey, thanks for trying, but that's not the answer I'm looking for here. You know, and then release when the horse or the animal is searching for it. So it's a really interesting dynamic. And, you know, like I said in the very beginning, you have to treat a mule the way you should treat a horse. But any horse, draft horse, mini, donkey, you know, any of these animals, when you use the type of communication that they are familiar with, you'll have a clarity in your communication for them. And then they're happy to do what it is that you'd like them to do. Okay? They're happy to. But I'll tell you what, I have, you know, a group of mares that they remind these other horses to get out of the way all the time. All the time. We're out there, you know, petting them the other day. I turned him out in pasture to go on this little trip, and I'm headed out, and one just reached over and just, you know, put her teeth into the other one. Now, it didn't, you know, wound her or anything, and you know, it's just, it's their dynamic, but it's really interesting when we see those things, the extent of the bite between these animals, and to understand that that bite is simply their form of communication. It's not aggressive. They were eating out of the same hay pile before I left the pasture. You know, it's just their form of communication. It's their way of understanding what it is that the other one wants. And it's very important. It's critical for them to understand us. You know, we can sit there and beg and hope and plead and doubt ourselves and watch more videos and all kinds of things. But you really just, if you just trust yourself and go out and try it, and all of a sudden your mule will look at you and go, well, of course I'd be happy to move. Why didn't you say so? Okay. But getting okay with that is a very difficult thing. And that's why this is horsemanship for women, because women oftentimes perceive physical contact as being a form of violence. And what I find with horses and the way I present it to a horse, it's not violent at all, because there's no emotion, there's no malice, there's no attacking. It's simply, you know, it would behoove you to not be there when the teeth get there, just like horses do with each other. So hopefully that'll give you an idea and a concept and a reassurance and the confidence to be able to go out, you know, and try it. But if your mule's been conditioned to just stand there and, you know, look at his watch and go, you know, I'm missing my favorite television show and you're going to quit, you know, it may take a while. It may take quite a bit. I've had some horses where it's taken quite a bit for them to, horses and mules, to decide that moving is the best answer, just because they've been conditioned not to move, because the person starts to doubt themselves, they get frustrated, and they quit. And the horse goes, oh, trained another human, see. So maybe that will give you some ideas to trust yourself and to really give that a try.
Okay, it'll be interesting, Karen, because we've got a interested mule owner that's wanting to come to the Indiana clinic. And so
that's
we may
great.
Get to see this firsthand here. So I'm not sure where, Carol, where you're from, but if you're close to Indiana and you want to bring your mule on over for that clinic, we've got a few spots still open, and that would be
yeah, mules, yeah, mules, donkeys, miniatures, draft horses, you know, everything's really always welcome. And now I will make one comment. If something is a male animal and still intact, that's probably the only thing that I can't include in a clinic. And not because, you know, you can't handle your stallion or you don't have a nice stallion or anything. It just changes the whole dynamic and the conditions of it. And the people around you are oftentimes unfamiliar with stallions. That's probably the only thing that if somebody has a stallion, I ask them, because if you have a stallion, it's even more urgent for you to get the education. But come and watch, get the videos, you practice those things. Because what I'm teaching people is leadership dynamics in herd behavior. And I'll tell you what, I encourage people, please develop your skills with a mare or a gelding first. And I've had people argue that upside down and backwards, but I've just seen, witnessed myself and experienced just too many, you know, opportunities. And stallions, they're like, you know, teenagers. They're great until you ask them to do something they don't want to do. And then their behavior patterns are much different than a mare or a gelding. So I'm just going to put that little disclaimer in there. You know, stallion should come with a warning label, and I don't care what breed it is. People say, oh, well, this breed of stallion isn't. Every stallion has a specific agenda. And until that specific agenda is removed by a veterinarian, it is there, and that is what you're dealing with. So it's just the fact.
Do you see it more even as spring's coming on and they're handling their stallions, Karen?
Well, you know, spring does change things because everything starts waking up. You know, pheromones and mares start waking up. You know, spring is in the air. And sure, you know, their thoughts, you know, become more intense towards that. But it can absolutely happen any time. And when people don't understand, you know, herd dynamics and that leadership is not about being aggressive, you know, or get after them, but it's not about being a wimp. See, there's a balance in leadership. But somewhere, it's understanding the difference between aggressive and assertive and the other difference between kind and being a wimp. see. And we can't demand for a horse or a human or a dog to respect us. You can't demand respect. I own you, I feed you, and this is how you treat me. You know, you better respect me. It doesn't work that way. You have to earn that. And how you earn that is by developing your qualities of leadership. And the number one quality of leadership that makes all the other qualities work is the quality of your communication. Because everybody can say, well, leaders are you know, have a plan, they're good at this, they listen, they're compassionate, they're all these kinds of things, and they are, but if you don't have a quality in your communication, how would anybody know you have those qualities of leadership? So the clarity in the communication is really key. And to me, the way to be clearest with any of these animals, you know, intact or geldings or, you know, foals or whatever, is to understand being able to emulate the behavior, the herd dynamics among horses. They understand that from day one. It's called socializing. So, and I hope that gives you some ideas there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for submitting your question. And Jan, we're going to go ahead and go on to your question. And it's, when I'm doing groundwork or just grooming and my horse startles, today it was just a huge gust of wind that suddenly rattled the metal barn doors and tossed a big round purple band through the air. And my horse suddenly and moved, and my reflexes is to get out of his way. I feel when I'm doing groundwork or just grooming and my horse startles today, actually she's kind of written that two different times here. She says, I feel that I should be pushing, jabbing it, him over so that he leans. You can move, but not through me. Should I only worry about him crowding me if the dominance thing that doesn't involve spooking, or do I need to somehow restrain my own startle reflex to stay safe but not let him move me? I'm not sure I can think that quickly.
Well, there's a lot of really good points in that question there. Who was it that wrote this?
This is Jan from Fort Collins.
Jan. Okay. Well, Jan, the thing there again, what I really enjoy about understanding and recognizing herd dynamics is if a horse startled from something in the herd, would they run into the lead horse? Okay, that's kind of one question there. And the answer is yes, but only once. The lead horse would simply, you know, go, you know, let me clear that up for you. Because here's the thing, when a horse recognizes leadership, the other aspect of it is they oftentimes don't startle or they don't spook. But it doesn't mean that they won't. You know, any horse can startle or spook something unexpected. You know, we do that. We turn the corner in our own house and a family member that we don't think is there suddenly appears. And, you know, we jump like, you know, somebody broke in the house or something. It's like, you know, it's crazy. Sometimes those senses just, you know, startle us. But the thing to really understand is to have those habits all the time and that awareness. So I have an awareness when my horse, say I'm taking them back out to the pasture, and my horse gets a little bit fast and starts going, well, you know, come on, Karen, let's pick it up a little bit, let's hurry it up a little bit, and he starts getting up next to me. To me, if something, you know, startles the horse on the other side, you know, I'm right there. Now, I have an automatic reflex to pick up my arm, specifically, you know, my forearm and my elbow, kind of on the far side of my forearm and elbow. And I have a habit of doing that. You know, if a horse is coming over to spook on top of me, I absolutely expect them not to run over me. So two things. If your groundwork is successful, and that's a kind of a key phrase right there, if it's successful, your horse will oftentimes be much less spooky, okay? So because they say, well, I'm, you know, here with my leader, so what do I have to be afraid of? So that dynamic will dramatically change with a lot of horses. But the successful means that the horse views you in the leadership position at all times and under every condition. See, that's a high definition of success. And a lot of times we get out there and we learn a few things, and the horse does this, and they do that, and they, you know, it kind of goes along pretty good. And the horse, you know, and if you think about from the horse's mind, it's like, well, you're the leader when nothing is challenging us. be. And that's why when people come to my courses and bring their horse into practicing things, they may have a really good foundation of things that's really nice to see. And sometimes, to be honest, people get frustrated because they go, well, I want you to see how good I'm doing. It's like, well, gosh, I see that. That's terrific. Now let's do something you and your horse aren't familiar with. See, humans and horses get very good at doing what we're familiar with. And it's important to continue to change the expectation, to raise the bar, to change it up, you know, surprise them, you know, do different things. And that's what we have the opportunity at a clinic to do. And I just, I've been shooting the advanced series of videos. And I'm using a horse that is kind of at that stage where everything's really pretty good, but how do you take it to another level? And why do you want to take it to another level? And that's kind of what you're describing there, is how do I take it to another level? So even when, you know, the bucket's flying and all heck's breaking loose, that horse is still tuned into you. So that's where I raise my expectations with a horse, is when we get into a situation, not if, but when we get into a situation, I'm going to activate my physiology even more to say, you know, hey, I need you to stay right here with me. Don't get mentally lost. It's right here, and I'll let you know, what we need to do. And that's really the quality of leadership. It's not that, you know, everything's going to be rainbows and butterflies, you know, forever and ever. That's an unrealistic expectation in my opinion. But the expectation I have is that I'm going to do my best to keep that connection of communication, to maintain that connection of communication under all situations. And that's why you're doing things on the ground, is to give yourself the muscle memory, because you don't have time to think about it when it happens. It just is going to happen. It's like the movie The Karate Kid, you know, with the wax on and wax off, and the, you know, the old man is teaching him, and he's painting the fence, and he's waxing the car, and the kid's like, you know, he's mad, why am I doing this, it's ridiculous, you know. And then the old man comes out when he's at a point of frustration, and that is one of the most amazing scenes in any movie. It just takes your breath away. All of a sudden the old man comes out, and he, you know, goes in to attack this kid, and because he had all the muscle memory, it's like, you know, ha, cha, 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 and they do this really fast exchange where, you know, he didn't need to tell him what he was doing. It's, you know, I have a purpose. I'm further down the road in this experience than you are. Trust me in this process. So those are all lots of elements in there, but, you know, it's being ready and conditioning yourself and your horse so that when things, you know, aren't what you expected them to be, you'll just have an automatic response to it. And sometimes you're just out of, you're in a situation. I guess it was last year sometime, I was leading my two horses, Berg and Deb, and I just went off at a little trot. We were headed out to the arena, and, you know, Deb has a nice big, you know, trot, and he kind of trotted up ahead of me, and a big arena sprinkler went off on the other side of him. And he didn't hit me, but he just came over enough that my feet were moving fast enough that my toe tripped over my own leg, and I went down. And I'll tell you what, all of a sudden you go, man, I need it even a little more. So you can't prevent everything, but every time something like that happens to you, what you have the opportunity to do is to reflect on where are you really at with your horse, and how could I take it even further. He didn't run into Berg. Berg was right behind me. He was like, well, I'm not running into Berg, but I'm going to clip Karen here. That's not that bad. So, you know, it's that dynamic. It's that leadership dynamic, and it's all the time. You're always on. It's just like how you are with your kids. You're not just, oh, mommy's tired today, you know, don't mess around. It's like, that's not the dynamic. And, you know, that's what we signed on for. This hobby of horses is not just a simple yes, no, this is what you do, you know, here's your recipe, and it's going to fix that. It's an expectation that you hold all the time with between you and your horse, for yourself and for your horse.
Okay. Karen, you've got so many great videos out there. Is there a particular one for Jan's current situation that you might suggest that she try to get a hold of?
Yes, all of them. Well, you know, people ask me that question all the time, and I realize I'm not doing somebody any favors by saying, you know, pick one. And I understand financial conditions and situations, believe me. But boy, I've seen lots of videos out there on the market, and mine are not, you know, hundreds of dollars. You don't have to take out a small, loan to get them. You know, they're to get the entire set of six videos. This is the foundation series of videos. It covers a variety of topics, on the ground, riding, trailer loading, general subjects, specific subjects. But it's $150 for the set of six. And people say, well, which one should I get? But if I tell you to get one, and the information that might save you is on video number five, you know, I didn't really do you a favor. I had a woman that commented on the knot tying video, and I talk about pocket knives, and I talk about that I carry two pocket knives and the types that I carry and how I carry them and why and all these things. And she was coming to the week-long course and was talking to a woman. She came from Nebraska, and she said the woman was asking about what she was going to, and she was telling her, and she said, well, you know, she was trying to describe, you know, what I do and my philosophy and that, and she talked about these two knives, and the woman's face just, you know, I guess changed, and she said, oh my gosh, she says, if my husband had been carrying two knives, one on either side, he could have reached the other pocket knife when his arm was caught and ended up losing his arm. If he had heard that piece of information back when, he would not have lost his arm. He would have been able to, you know, hopefully, but the way he was caught, he was unable to, to get himself free and ended up actually losing his entire arm. So, you know, when I hear things like, you know, she came to the week-long course and told me this story, and it just drives me. It drives me to tell people, you know, you need this information, and you don't know how or when or why it's going to happen, but if you don't have it, you know, you're at a loss. You're at a higher risk. Horses are risky anyway, but you're at an even higher risk without a base of knowledge. And that's why I'm so committed to teaching and generating new videos. We have a problem-solving series that's coming out here pretty soon, because I just get so heartbroken when I hear stories of people. A woman last week died from something, you know, a situation, not to say it couldn't have happened to me or anybody else, but, you know, she was on a horse that I was familiar with, and there were, you know, stages, you know, to this horse's development, and, you know, she was given guidance and offered suggestions, you know, but you can offer people information, but you can't make them, you know, take it. So, you know, it just breaks my heart to think that maybe something that she could have studied or examined or taken a different approach, you know, might have prevented that situation. You know, I don't know. I just feel very driven to help people really before they get hurt, you know, or worse. And to be honest, you know, with the amount of information that's out there, you know, we put so much money into, you know, the horse, the trailer, the truck to pull it, you know, the best board we can afford, the best feed, the best vet care, all these things. Relatively speaking, knowledge is a very small financial part that people, you know, invest in themselves. Where any other hobby, you can get away with that. You know, if you're a bad golfer or a bad tennis player or a bad, you know, quilter, you know, nothing really happens. But in something that is that big, that powerful, and a prey animal psychology that you're dealing with, the investment of knowledge to me is really, really important. You know, it could mean, you know, not losing a body part or your life, and not just for yourself, but maybe for others. You know, I think that would be the worst feeling, is to think something, you know, that happened with me harmed somebody else. So it's really important, and a real commitment that I have, and hopefully other people share, you know, just by my explanation of it, possibly.
Karen, when do you anticipate releasing your advanced video? Do you know yet?
I'm not allowed to say.
Oh. By the Indiana Clinic, right?
I cannot say. I get in trouble because, you know, I'm so excited about doing these things, and you know, people really don't realize what it takes to, you know, produce educational material. You know, so things get put out there and they are in production, but it's a big challenge. It's not as easy as a lot of people think. So I'm not allowed to say it anymore. I get in trouble because I always think, oh yeah, you know, here it'll be out next month, you know. But and the people who are producing it are going, you know, why did you say that? I was like, well, how hard is it?
It sounded educated like a good
on. Thing. It sounded like a good thing.
Yeah, okay. So we'll go ahead and move on here to Pam's question. And I think you're going to find this one really interesting. This one is, she says, I'm very familiar with the racehorses, and I've recently been offered the chance to purchase an Andalusian horse. But I know nothing about them. I've been researching them, but also wanted to get an opinion from you since you have two, Berg and Deb. And what can you tell me about these Andalusians that I should know before buying one?
Okay. Well, Andalusians, and I have different breeds of horses. I have Arabians. I have quarter horses. I've had a saddlebred standardbred. I have had a Pasofino. You know, I've had different, you know, breeds of horses. I have a little Pinto named Rio, and she's the old professor. She's a great teacher for people. But in recent years, in the last, I guess it's been probably 9 years now. I'm always guessing. I'm always a couple of years behind. I decided to get an Andalusian because of the versatility of activities that I like to enjoy. So I enjoy everything from polo cross to cattle to dressage to jumping. It's really a wide variety of things. And using my horse, you know, for teaching, you know, I need a horse that's very solid. I can, you know, ride all day. They have a strength to them, and a high play drive. I need a horse that's interested in doing a variety of those things. So, you know, my selection of an Andalusian, you know, when I looked at all the breeds, the Iberian breeds, particularly the Andalusians and Lusitanos, seem to be the breeds that would give me that kind of versatility. And I've been very happy with it. I did decide, you know, I picked both Berg and Deb are kind of what I consider project horses. You know, they weren't just started and off and everything's all good. They were kind of, you know, challenging in their own way. Berg, because he has a very high play drive, and he just was a nonconformist. You know, he got into the show routine, and he kind of went, this is just not for me. So, you know, he and the people I bought him from were very honest about it, and you know, he is a lot of horse, you know. And so people see him and they go, oh, he's so wonderful. And I said, yeah, can you see the little halo balanced on his ears? He's so innocent.
I saw it when you were here.
What's that?
I said, I saw that when you were here with him one time.
Yeah, did you see that?
A neat horse.
Well,
yeah.
Well, he spent, you know, and I don't know what his experiences were. I don't begin to guess, but probably the first 3 years I owned him, he nip people, you know, just as a game. People go up to pet him and they go, oh, here's Brigante, you know. And, you know, you can tie a ribbon in a horse's tail to say, you know, the horse has a tendency to kick at it. I don't know. I could tie a red ribbon to his ears and say, you know, and you could bet money on it. Yeah, you know, I'd be so far away, I couldn't do anything. And they go up and pet him, and he'd look really innocent. He, you know, his big eyes and everything. And all of a sudden, you'd see him jump, and I go, yeah, they got him. And I mean, you could bet $10. You could go, yeah, he'll lure him in, and then he'll just give him a little nip. And you know, it just for fun. It just is kind of his nature of being this mischievous, you know, kind of a thing. When we talk about labeling and you know, I have a theory around naming horses and things. I kind of joke that the name Brigante is a Castilian word, which means a scoundrel or a rascal. And I tell people, you know, find out what your horse's name means before you buy him, because he really is, you know, a scoundrel. And but he's just been absolutely a tremendous horse for me. And he's really been the horse that has taken me, you know, my horsemanship. It's always a journey for everybody, you know, and their horses have something to teach you always. But this particular individual is a horse that I got him when I thought I kind of knew something. I went, oh yeah, I'm a level, you know, whatever. And, you know, I'm going to train you. And I, you know, in hindsight, I think he was looking at me going, oh, you poor, pathetic little person, you know, let me show you what you don't know. And everything that I thought I knew and I had used on, you know, lots of horses, it did not work for him. And I kept going out there. You know, the definition of insanity is keep doing the same thing, expecting a different result. And I just kept thinking, well, he's going to get it. And, you know, I'm going to use my dominance. And I had this dominance, you know, word in my head. And I'm going to, you know, do this thing. And he's the horse that really taught me the difference between dominance and leadership. If you think of somebody who's been a great example of leadership in your life, you don't think of that person and go, oh, yeah, they're dominant. Okay, they're a micromanager and a control freak. See, those words are not included in the qualities of true leadership. And that horse really taught me that. I finally, one day, I just stopped and I just went, okay, Bergante, please teach me. Please teach me. And in that moment, I felt a distinct shift where he looked at me and said, okay, now we're getting somewhere. See, I had to exhaust what I thought I knew. But that's a stage that you go through, you know, with horses. And just when you think you kind of know something, you're about to find out what you don't know. So that's been my personal experience with, you know, Bergante was the first named illusion. Deb is another, you know, project horse. He was, you know, started as a young horse, really turned out for quite a few years in the yearling pasture, where he really had no horses or humans really above him in that leadership. He was Uncle Deb out there. So, you know, he's been a completely, you know, different experience. And each horse is an individual. And but I've just really had a ball with the horses. They're very engaging. They love new things. They love to be challenged. You know, they're bred for it. They're built for it. And both of these horses came from Europe. My preference is the, I don't know, you know, in quarter horses you call it foundation. You know, it's like in Morgan's, there's a foundation Morgan and a, you know, in a show Morgan. There, you know, there's different characteristics, but these horses are heavy boned, broad chested. You know, they have beautiful gaits, and they're very. When things are right for them, they'll give you everything. But if things are not right for them, they're not the easiest horse, you know. And people who breed Andalusians and things like that, they may argue that. But it's kind of like, you know, Arabians get labeled as being difficult or crazy, things like that. The Arabians are amazing. They're an amazing breed. Intelligence and endurance and physiology and versatility and all those kinds of things. But you have to have a skill set to be able to tap into that. If you don't have the skill set to tap into it, all those, you know, qualities work against you. It's like the kid in school. The one who's most trouble is the one that just, they're probably bored. They're not challenged, or the teaching style is not effective for them. So, you know, it's something to just, you know, keep in mind. It's not like, oh, you're going to get an Andalusian, it's going to be rainbows and butterflies. You know, it as with any horse. But there are, you know, when I want to say, I don't want to say easier breeds, because there's individuals within breeds. But in the learning stages, if somebody's in the learning stages with horses, you know, and you can find an individual in Andalusian that would be suited for them. I tended to find Andalusians that were, you know, kind of a challenge in their own individual, you know, kind of way. Because that's what keeps me moving and motivated and shaping behavior and chipping away at, you know, how to reach those horses at a very deep level, both mentally, emotionally, and physically. So,
okay.
That's my experience with the Andalusians.
Okay.
But, you know, the cool thing about looking for horses is go try them. Go try them. I tell people, here's a simple formula. If you want to find a really, really good horse, commit to looking at least 10 horses. Just commit from the get-go, 10 horses. Even if it's the first one you looked at isn't one you want, resist that urge. And if you want to find a really great horse that you'll have and enjoy for a lifetime, commit to looking at 20. And it's a simple formula. And people can say, well, what about breed? What about this? What about that? If you'll commit to that, and I knew I wanted Andalusians, and I probably did look at a dozen, maybe 15, you know, different horses for each one of them before I selected these. So, and it's just something, don't get in a hurry, you know, to get a horse. And I tell people, you know, who wish you dated more before, you know, you maybe made a commitment. It's like, you know, dating, lots of dating is the key.
Okay, well,
you're dating.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, Pam, we want to wish you good luck with that, and hopefully that works out well for her. So, Karen, we've got one other question this evening that we've got time for here real quick. And
sure.
This one's from Deborah, and this is in regards to the photonic light. And I am so glad that you showed me that way while you were here in Indiana, and you know my history with it. And she says, I'm very an outside-of-the-box thinker, and I've been researching the photonic therapy with equines, and I've done the reading, but do you mind explaining the process, the philosophy to us?
Sure. Very simply, what photonic therapy does is it uses a light to stimulate acupuncture points. So it basically replaces the needle that acupuncturists use, the pressure that acupressurists use. Light, this particular band of light, penetrates into tissue about an inch and a half. And I met the inventor of this many years ago. His name is Dr. McLaren. He's retired to Australia with his wife at this stage. But he's a veterinarian, and he is a master acupuncturist. He studied many years in China, and he got to a certification level where he was the teacher. He taught acupuncturists and certified them. So, you know, very highly skilled. And as a veterinarian, he found that horses would not tolerate the needles. And he remembered a light that some experiments done with light properties. And he remembered one particular band of light had a property it would penetrate collagen about an inch and a half because of the wavelength of this particular band of light. And so it's basically, if you took a flashlight in a dark room, you could see through your fingers, but maybe not through the palm of your hand. With this light, you go into a dark room, and you see very clearly through the palm of your hand. You put it on your forearm, you know, unless you're, you know, a big guy with giant muscles, but, you know, I'll see through, you know, parts of my forearm. So it's the depth of the penetration. So that wavelength of light actually goes in and stimulates those acupuncture points. And acupuncture is a very, very old modality for healing. And basically your body is run on electrical current. And your neural pathways are that mechanism to transfer the messages from your brain to the rest of the body. And we all know there's, you know, millions of functions that are going on, you know, at a cellular level at all times in our body. So when we have resistance that builds up in our neural pathways, I'll give you an example that Dr. McLaren gave me very early on, because I was asking that same question. I said, you know, I have a knee injury in my left knee. It's an old sports injury. And if I keep my knee bent for any amount of time, like 15, 20 minutes, it begins to throb. I'd have to sit in planes and, you know, movie theaters or something like that to where I could straighten my leg and straighten my knee out to keep it comfortable. And he said, and it was about 11 years that I'd had that injury. And so it was in that condition for 11 years. And I had a doctor say, well, you know, eventually you'll need, you know, knee surgery. Just go along as long as you can and, you know, da-da-da. And he said, basically what happened when that injury occurred, your body sent the healing message to, your brain sent the message to heal to the rest of your body and healed your knee for, he said, you know, kind of about 2 weeks, 2.5, you know, 3 weeks, the body gets the message to heal that knee. And then at that point, the brain and the body says, well, I've done about all I can. Now we're going to start laying down scar tissue. And that's where, you know, the chronic condition begins. And he said, what's happened is to lay down that scar tissue and then desensitize to it, your neural pathways have, it doesn't fire as clearly, so it desensitizes, so it shuts down your neural pathways, you know, not completely, but to a certain stage. When you stimulate those points, what it's doing is reopening those neural pathways. The brain goes, oh, we have a knee injury, and keeps those neural pathways open to continue the healing, you know, until you really have, you know, a lasting result. And so I kind of went, okay, well, you know, that all sounds really good. And so, you know, I borrowed a red light, and it was really interesting because I didn't really believe it at the time. You know, here's a light that's going to fix my knee, you know, where a doctor has said, you know, eventually surgery, you know, everybody, you know, we have a bad knee when you get older. And I used it, and the whole time I was using it, I kept thinking, oh, this isn't going to work. This is stupid. You know, what's this going to do? But I thought, okay, if it just reduces the pain by half, I'd be happy, because if I get stuck in the situation, I mean, it would drop to a point of tears. It would really hurt that bad. And it took about 6 weeks, and I just kept putting that light on my knee. I didn't feel anything. I mean, you know, had no sensations, nothing. And all of a sudden, one day, I just went, gosh, you know, my knee doesn't hurt. I realized I wasn't kind of straightening my knee and stuff, and it just didn't feel achy. And I continued for another week after that. And to this day, that was probably It's got to be more than 10 years now. My knees feel exactly the same. They to this day. And it hasn't been something that's come back or anything like that. It just absolutely, you know, changed that. When that happened, I went, okay, there is really something to this. But I have used it on so many things. I just can't encourage people to try it more. I do a money-back guarantee on it. If it doesn't help you, it doesn't, you know, make a difference for you, you know, I want it back. That's how I am with all my products. But that photonic therapy, and Melinda, you had that experience where even the doctor said to you, you know, what are you doing that, you know, you healed this quickly? Never seen anything like it. And it's really tremendous. I've used it on so many different things. I could go on and on about it. But there's just no reason to sit there in pain or discomfort or have a bad back or your neck hurts or, you know, fill in the blank. Or your horse, I've used it on lots of colics. Because I travel all over the country, you come across horses that are colicking. And it has an absolutely amazing result on colics. So, you know, I've had situations where my horse has kind of a bellyache, and it gives me such peace of mind. I just go, you know, I know that I can use this red light and have my horse, you know, feel better. I know that I can do something about it. And not to say, you know, it replaces a veterinarian. It doesn't do that at all, but it gives you something to do to accelerate the healing, to keep the neural pathways open. And it's nothing newfangled or anything. It's as old as acupuncture. It's just a different mode of accessing acupuncture.
Okay. Well, I know it's really worked well for me, and I know you've wanted me to write an article a little bit about what happened and things, and I've been so good and so better that I haven't sit down and taken time to do it because I'm getting to do what I love doing instead. I'll get that to you.
Things around, you know, chronic things that people think they have to live with their whole life, like allergies, migraine, headaches, you know, things like that. And people will say, well, will it work on, you know, and before they answer, I just say, yeah, you know, it really does. My friend Dan Moyer, you know, he's had back surgery, and, you know, I don't know, he might get mad at me for saying this, but I don't know if he would have tried it, just me telling him about it, but a good friend of his, Bob King, used it and just has had tremendous results. You know, Bob told Dan about it, and Dan used it, and boy, he's a big supporter because, you know, he's had some major things done with his back, and he said it really helps him, you know, continue to you know, be as physical as he needs to be for what he does and what he enjoys doing. So you don't have to live with aches and pains. Don't convince yourself that, oh, here's my plight. You know, you actually can do something about it because you can have the right nutrition and the right, you know, exercise and all these kinds of things. But if your neural pathways, there isn't anything to keep your neural pathways open, your brain isn't always in the optimum condition to have the proper, you know, utilization of nutrition and, you know, optimum circulation and, you know, all these kinds of things. So,
well, you know, Mike was so skeptical about it, and now he's like, maybe you ought to go get the red light.
Is he using it?
He's advising me to use it. So, he's used it a couple times, and he's coming on board with it. He's seeing that it works, and he's got a very scientific-type mind. So he's coming on board with it. So
The benefits. Well, you know, and that's the thing. It's important to not, you know, just take somebody's word for it, and, you know, don't take my word for it. Just use it. Mm-hmm. If you will just use it. My mother was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, And, you know, I was living in Colorado at the time, and, you know, I got her a red light, and my sister said, you know, she's in the medical field, and she's going, oh, come on, you know. And finally, she started treating my mom with the red light twice a day, when she'd go to work and when she'd come home for a couple of weeks. And, you know, all of the symptoms for fibromyalgia went away completely. And, you know, the doctor said, oh, it must have been a misdiagnosis. Well, you know, but if we wouldn't have done this red light, you know, what would have happened, and would she have been on meds for the rest of her life? You know, you don't know. And that's why it's really hard, you know, if I start to get a headache or, you know, something, you know, here's the two hardest things. Number one is thinking of using it, and number two is giving it credit when it works. You know, I'll use it, I'll start getting a headache, and I'll use it around the base of my neck or my temples, you know, wherever that is, and then I don't get a headache. You don't even think about it. And then you go, well, maybe I wasn't really going to get a headache. See, your brain, your rational brain kind of kicks in and interferes with it. But I'll tell you what, my horses tell me they love it, because I'll go out and had 6 horses when I started using this, and I do just the general points on the first horse, and when I go to the second horse, the first one would follow me. I go to the third horse, and horse number 1 and 2 would be, you know, crowding around. And by the time I got to the 6th horse, I mean, they're all just like pushing into it, and I'll see horses actually present, you know, the sides of their body or areas. You just get a sense of it, that they, you know, want that red light put on them. Dogs, cats, you know, it's really an amazing tool, and I wish people would just try it. If it doesn't work for you, I'll take it back. And we did find a version of it, a more recent development of it, that has a higher intensity light. It's smaller. I actually carry it on me all the time, and you may see it in my, you know, new videos, because I just have it on me all the time, and it's really amazing. I'll be driving down the road and go, gosh, I'm getting a crick in my neck from driving or something like that, and it's just right on me. I just pick it up, and, you know, I just use it so much more. My hands get sore if I have some really challenging horses, and, you know, I just, you know, I'm sitting there, and I'll just pull it out and turn on the light and just, you know, treat my hands. And, you know, I have to keep myself going physically. I think we all do. But in order for me to, you know, keep doing what I do, I have to keep my body in a condition that I can, I want to do what I do for as long as I can do it. And it really does help me do that.
Well, Karen, we really appreciate the many ways that you're reaching out to the horse owners. And, you know, you've got many articles that you've had information written in different magazines, like Horse Illustrated and Horse Rider and Western Horseman and some others. And then, you know, you offer the clinics to us and the videos and this teleseminar and TV programs. And now you're even on Facebook. So we just really appreciate how much you're reaching out to all of us. And,
well, thanks.
We certainly appreciate everybody submitting their questions to us. And we try to get to them as quickly as we can. And please keep those coming. And, Karen, time flies by. It's already time for us to kind of close this and wrap this up. And do you have anything last minute here you'd like to finish off with?
Well, I'm headed up to Colorado. I'm going up to the Rocky Mountain Horse Expo in Denver this weekend. And the following weekend I'll be at the 4 States Ag Expo in Cortez, Colorado. So I've got kind of a little Colorado trip coming up here. But there's lots of clinics on the schedule, and there's 2 clinics. Your clinic filled up so much there, Melinda, that you have a second clinic going on, and there's a discount if people want to ride in both clinics. So I'm really excited about being back to your place in Indiana and all different places. I was invited up to an expo in Canada and got a message from Equine Wellness Magazine, who was just in a meeting with the folks that are organizing that. And there's just lots of really exciting things that are coming up. So, you know, stay in touch. Go on the website. We've made some nice changes and some revisions to that. Get on Facebook. You know, we have some fun things that are happening there. It's a great way that I can keep people connected. And it's a wonderful support to the horse community on Facebook. I'm really, really enjoying that. More than I thought. I was scared of it at first, to be honest. I was on it for 5 days and got off of it. But I found a way to you know, find another venue, another way to get information out to people. So it's working really well now.
Well, that's great.
But Yeah, but I want to thank you, Melinda, for hosting the show. And you're on Facebook. We've sent out a reminder and have a nice little picture of you and Mike on there on Facebook. So I don't know if you've even seen that.
I have not seen that. I have to check that out. So
So if you want to know what Melinda and Mike look like, you can look on Facebook and you'll see it right there.
Great. Thanks.
No problem.
Okay. Well, listen, we thank everybody for joining us tonight. Please tune in next month. Keep your questions coming, and everybody keep safe, and we'll talk to you next month. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thanks, Melinda.